Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. It's 9:01. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, the guest is David Swanson, author of Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. Marianne Bersonek hosts.
Good morning and welcome to Political Perspectives. My name is Marianne Bersonek and my guest today is David Swanson. Now, Swanson's been a force in the anti-war movement for many years. He co-founded the website AfterDowningStreet.org and has been a consultant on the Kucinich presidential campaigns. He's here to talk about his new book, Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. David, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us.
Glad to. Thanks for having me.
Now, what do you mean by an imperial presidency?
Well, there is a clear connection to the actual empire that we have built and the wars that we use to expand it. But principally, I mean the expansion of powers of the presidency. And to a lot of people, this seems like sort of a secondary concern. The whole government is rotten. It's corrupted by money and media and parties and unverifiable elections and so forth. What does it matter which part of the government has the powers? But it ought to be a huge concern to us, I argue in the book, that we've moved all the powers that used to be in the Congress to the White House, to the hands of a single individual and future single individuals, because we have very limited ability to control them, even in comparison to our ability to control our representatives in the Congress.
You mean Obama isn't going to solve all of our problems?
Well, that's one of the most depressing, bizarre, fantastic notions of the past year and a half or so. You know, we spent all this time making great sacrifices to try to end wars, among other things, while we have a government that's dead set against it, virtually impossible, not a chance. We'll fund the peace movement and mobilize the peace movement while there's no chance for peace. And then the minute that we elect some people who we think, rightly or wrongly, might be a little more likely to opt for peace if we force them to, we defund and demobilize and go home and sit on our hands and wait and see what happens. And of course, the wars continue and expand. This is not something unique to this particular election or this particular individual in the White House. Elections never solve anything. Activism begins after elections. And so it's a crazy sort of expectation, followed by predictable disappointment, that it's a whole cycle that shouldn't be gone through. We should begin activism, as President Obama says, get out there and make me do it. We should do that the minute an election is over, but our focus should be on our representatives in the House of Representatives, because if they stop paying the money for these wars must end. The Senate and the President and the whole industrial complex can do whatever they want, but they can't fight wars without money.
Well, I think what you just said about this cycle where when we elect someone who's looks like they might end the war, all the activism kind of dies down is something that is really, I can see as a problem here in Portland. Everybody kind of got burnt out and then they went, phew, Obama's in power, so let's. But it seems like getting Obama elected didn't do a lot, and it doesn't seem like all of the anti-war activity didn't do a lot either.
Well, a couple of points there. One is that anti-war activism in recent years has forced the United Nations to oppose the war on Iraq, making it illegal, which facilitates the possibility of someday holding people accountable for that crime, has thus far prevented an attack on Iran that they've been lobbying for with very similar lies for years, has been a major force in counter-recruitment. They are fighting. Obama is fighting just as a President McCain would have fought the wars exactly to the extent that they have the troops to fight. And there's other problems of mercenaries and foreign allies, but we are discouraging recruitment. There are all kinds of successes at the local and state and national levels that we don't hear about, that the corporate media doesn't tell us about, that they tell us the stories as if the activism hadn't been part of it. And so we have to, for those of us who need victories and encouragement, we have to tell each other and seek out that information. And I use my website, AfterDowningStreet.org, to tell people what victories are being won in other parts of the country. I think that's very important. But the other point is that that I wouldn't have wanted President Obama to fix everything, even if I had some sort of fantasy that he might of his own accord do it, because the next president could simply come in and unfix everything. It's a very unstable sort of a government to depend on a benevolent dictator for 4 years, who's then going to be replaced by perhaps a much less benevolent dictator. I want those powers in the Congress, and I want the people to control the Congress, and I want the executive to execute the will of the Congress. And we don't have that now. We have everyone, pro-war and anti-war, accepting that war powers belong to the president, and that's very dangerous.
Okay, you're listening to Political Perspectives. I'm Marianne Barisonic. My guest is David Swanson, U.S. author, blogger, and activist. Now, Bush and Cheney are gone. Aren't the issues with the abuses of power gone with them?
No, the power grab is being firmly cemented in place now and over the past 11 or 12 months, much more so than any one administration ever could have done. When President Obama and the new Congress came in, they could have treated the Bush-Cheney expansions of presidential power as something of an aberration to be undone and reversed. They could have followed through on things like the president's very eloquent campaign promises to undo signing statements and not use signing statements to reverse laws. Instead, the current president, not as many yet, not as egregious, but writes signing statements undoing and altering laws in exactly the same manner that Cheney's lawyer did for Bush. We have presidents now who claim powers of secrecy, the power to shut down court cases with claims of state secrets that Bush and Cheney never tried. We're seeing these powers expanded. The presidents now make laws by telling Congress what laws to make, by executive order, by signing statement, and by secret memos. And the current administration is treating those secret memos produced under Bush, legalizing, as they call it, torture and aggressive war, as law, as legitimate documents. And we have the power to make war, the power to make treaties, the power to make appointments, the power to imprison people without charge or process, the powers to torture, the power of rendition, the power to grant retroactive immunity, far worse than pardon. These are all firmly established in the White House now. And if we let this administration run its course without reversing these things, it will be very, very hard to undo this power shift.
Well, how did we get here? Let's take the example of treaties. How did the president get to basically unilaterally sign treaties?
Well, the president's always been able, under the Constitution, to go and make treaties, but then they have to be ratified by two-thirds of senators present in the Senate. And that's been blurred since World War II in this expansion of an empire of bases, in that we've had these status of forces agreements and these things that are sort of called executive agreements, not exactly treaties. We'll call them something else and leave the Senate out of it. But what happened towards the end of the Bush presidency, when he went and made a treaty for 3 years of war in Iraq with a puppet occupied government of Iraq, and did not ask the Senate for its consent? This was new. This was different from anything they'd previously mislabeled a status of forces agreement. This was the power to make wars put into a treaty, and the treaty made without the Senate. Senator by the name of Barack Obama was quite upset about this, thought the Senate should have a say. A guy by the name of Joe Biden put in a bill that said we won't fund the occupation of Iraq unless the Senate gets to vote this thing up or down. This is a treaty. Now Obama and Biden treat that as a legitimate document, as their legal cover for the illegal occupation of Iraq. And so now you have the Republicans who obeyed Bush, refusing to object, and now you have the Democrats who obey Obama, refusing to object, and you have this pattern established that presidents can make these treaties. And so how does the Congress then hold them to it if they violate it, if they make another treaty to extend the occupation, or they make another similar treaty in a neighboring country? It's a precedent, and we have to be careful of these precedents.
Well, I think this idea that Congress is showing no initiative at all, they don't seem to want to gain back the powers that they had. What's going on there? Why do we have a completely ineffective Congress?
Well, they don't have any interest. They don't want to vote on wars. Somebody would be mad at them whichever way they voted. They'd rather just shove it off on the president and let him make war decisions. But they have not just the right, but the responsibility to make those decisions. The Constitution requires Congress to make the decisions of whether we launch wars and escalate wars, and they must fund them or not fund them. They aren't interested. They aren't interested in Congress as a branch of government. They're interested in their parties. Their loyalty is either to the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. Those are now the two branches of our government. And so at any given time, roughly half of Congress is loyal to the guy who was supposed to execute the will of Congress, which was supposed to have all the powers to legislate and raise and spend money and so forth. Look at this bill that has a vast majority of House members already co-sponsoring it. If they would just bring it up for a vote, it would pass immediately. Just to let Congress audit the Fed, just to see what the Federal Reserve does with our money. God forbid Congress should control what's done with our money as the Constitution requires. They aren't interested. They aren't interested in power. They're interested in their own individual power within the party that funds their campaigns and controls what happens to them in the bubble they live in on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, and I think one of the points that you make in either in the book or one of the talks I was listening to was that the president is extremely isolated. It's very difficult to get at him. But your representatives, I mean, I can go down and talk to Wu or Wyden, and they're here. They're accessible. They're not surrounded by Secret Service guys, but they seem to have abdicated all of their responsibilities.
Yes, indeed. The president isn't up for 4 years, can ignore entire states. There's a handful of swing states, is corrupted by the corporate media night and day, has taken 10 times the money of any senator from any given industry and so forth. It's very hard to influence a president. It's virtually impossible to influence a senator. With House members, yeah, it's very, very difficult. But to the extent that we reform the system and make it easier to influence anybody, it's going to be our representatives in the House. And so lobbying the leadership of Congress to fix the health care bill is very, very difficult compared to lobbying your representative to take a stand. And lobbying your representative to cut off the money for war, impossible as it may seem, is far easier than yelling at the president, and is going to actually mobilize people who are afraid for whatever crazy reasons to yell at the president. So we have to get back to an understanding of what powers belong in Congress and then force Congress to represent us.
Okay, this is Political Perspectives on KBOO in Portland. I'm Marianne Barasonic. My guest is David Swanson. He's the creator of the website convictbushcheney.org and Washington Director of Democrats.com. And we'll be opening the lines for your calls in about 15 minutes, so you might want to start thinking about questions here for David. And just to get you ready for this, the phone number here is 503-231-8187. Now, David, you're not a big fan of the Senate, even given that we, you know, need to have the representatives and it's better to be lobbying Congress than the president. What have you got against the Senate?
Well, the Senate has never, if the Senate has ever done anything good for us, let me know. Educate me. I know of very few examples where the Senate has taken a better position than the House or a more populist majoritarian position than the House. The Senate is always further from the people, and it does not serve the residents of small states better than the House. It does not do anything good. It makes all legislation worse, and it allows, because of the disproportionate representation, it allows people, old millionaire white guys who represent 17% of Americans, to block all legislation in the Senate and therefore most legislation in the House. And when you add in this crazy rule called the filibuster, it allows people who represent 11 or 12% of us to block all legislation in the Senate and the House. Now, getting rid of the Senate,
Can we back up there?
Yeah.
How does 11 or 12% the people representing 11 or 12% stop legislation?
Well, 41 senators, if you take those 41 from the smallest states, can block any piece of legislation by saying we shall filibuster, which nowadays doesn't even require that they get up and read the dictionary. They simply have to say we will filibuster. Any 41 senators say that, a bill stops in the Senate, and a bill that has to be passed by both houses, even if it's passed the House, doesn't matter. It doesn't become law because it's not passing the Senate. Now, the filibuster is not in the Constitution. It's not in the Bible. It's just a rule. They can throw it out tomorrow. Senator Harkin is putting in a bill that would modify the filibuster rule, but that bill could be filibustered. The solution is for 50 senators tomorrow to change the rule, to throw out the filibuster rule. That would be a dramatic improvement in the Senate. Then you could have majority rule rather than minority rule, rule by 41.
Okay, now this idea about throwing out the filibuster is just one of the ideas that you have in your book, Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. What are some of the other things that you think we should be doing or lobbying for to create a more perfect union?
Well, it occurs to me that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals sits in this town on occasions, and there's a judge there with a lifetime seat by the name of Jay Bybee, B-Y-B-E-E, Jay Bybee. Go to impeachbybee.org, because if he cannot be impeached, there is no more impeachment power. And if there is no more impeachment power, there is no more Congress as a branch of government that can put fear into any other branch of government. And I say that because this man ran the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department for Bush and Cheney, which produced secret memos that were treated as law, legalizing aggressive war and torture, famously torture, but also aggressive wars at the whim of any future president. This man's name is at the bottom of these memos.
Let's talk about that issue, the aggressive wars at the whim of a president. How did that happen? What was in Bybee's memos that made that happen?
Well, and who knows who wrote the bulk of some of these memos. Many may have been primarily authored by a guy named John Yoo, who's well known, but who worked for Jay Bybee. But Jay Bybee's name is at the bottom of the worst of these lengthy memos. And it's interesting that a lot of their argument amounts to Bill Clinton did it. You know, you have this partisan bickering cover in the media of the two parties hate each other and Bill Clinton's a socialist, the same as you have now with Obama. But in legal arguments, Bill Clinton was the justification for what they wanted to do. He had bombed Iraq. He had gone into Yugoslavia and so forth. What he did, we have the legal right to do bigger and badder. And so the argument was made that a president simply has the power domestically without Congress to launch a war in defense of our nation, even if that simply means telling a bunch of lies and attacking somebody halfway around the globe.
But that's unconstitutional.
Yes, of course it's unconstitutional, which is why there was quite a scandal when some of these memos came out last spring, although the focus was on the torture memos, not the aggressive war memos, which I think are a little too much for the U.S. corporate media to handle. But these are blatant crimes. These are legal documents purporting to legalize blatant unconstitutional crimes, down in black and white with these gentlemen's names at the bottom. The Justice Department for years now has been doing its own report on the misdeeds of these lawyers, which has yet to be released. The Attorney General promised in November it would be out in November. Here we are in January. One reason it may still not be out is that one of John Yoo's victims is suing him for damages, and there's a date for an appeal in that in a couple of weeks. And clearly the president does not want Jose Padilla's lawyer to have this report. But we don't need a report to tell us what went wrong, because we have many of the memos, and they are confessions to felonies.
But so we have confessions to felonies. We have, and this is not little stuff. This is huge, egregious stuff. We're talking about basically mass murder when you get down to it.
Yes.
And yet, and there's all kinds of laws against it, but those laws aren't being enforced.
That's right. That's right. And there are civil suits that are making good progress. There's potential for other civil suits. There are international investigations and possible indictments coming. There are all sorts of angles, and there is pressuring the Justice Department to enforce justice. But the Justice Department doesn't actually work for us. We don't elect it. We don't fund it. we have our representatives in Congress who theoretically represent us, although in reality they rarely do. But we can mobilize, and we ought to mobilize, and we have a moral responsibility to mobilize many times over what we ever did when Bush and Cheney were running the country, to force our representatives to represent us, to take action as they did proposing an impeachment of Alberto Gonzalez, which caused him to resign as attorney general. If they cannot take that same action against someone like Jay Bibee and get him off a court, a man who legalizes the supreme international crime of aggressive war and individual torture laws, how you can torture this guy, how you can torture that guy. If this man can sit on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals as a judge and overturn the rulings of decent judges in our judicial system, then there is no more Congress as a branch of our government.
Are there any plans in the works now for prosecuting crimes of the Bush administration, and how effective would that be?
Well, there are strategies for prosecuting at the local and state level for various crimes, including war. Former prosecutor Vince Bugliosi has a strategy he's working on to get a local prosecution for the murder of U.S. troops sent to Iraq. He hasn't figured out how to get a prosecution for the murder of the Iraqis, and so forth. And there are the civil suits, and there are all the other strategies. But it would be far more advantageous to the future of our republic if we forced Congress to take the lead on this. And it is the weak link. It is where we have the most influence. So my strategy is to pressure congressional committees to subpoena and impeach. They went through a charade of 2007 and 2008, 2 years of sending subpoenas to people like Dick Cheney and Condi Rice and the whole gang of them, who simply said, no, I won't comply with a subpoena. Come 2009, they don't reissue a single one of those. And last spring, Senator Leahy says to Jay Bibee, would you mind coming in and speaking with us? And Jay Bibee says no. And the senator says, I'm sorry, I troubled you. And that's that. If we cannot force those subpoenas to start and an impeachment hearing to be proposed, that's all it takes, is to propose it, to put fear into the Justice Department, then Congress can't be listened to in Washington. Congress can be ignored, even if we force them to stop funding the wars, as I'm working for. The president could still fund the wars. So we have to make this happen.
It sounds like there's a few things, a few pressure points, that if people were able to actually focus on that, we could get that rolling. What kind of effects do you think that this would have overall on the system if we could even hold somebody like Bibee accountable?
Nothing would do more to end and discourage similar crimes. These wars are ongoing. They're being escalated. New ones are being contemplated. Strikes are being launched into other countries, in complete violation of domestic and international law. This would not be going on. The current presidency, whoever held it, would be behaving very differently if his or her predecessors had been held accountable, or were facing the possibility of being held accountable. You cannot come in and say, I will not prosecute torturers, I will not permit the prosecution of torturers, and I will ban torture by executive fiat, when torture has been illegal in every form and instance for years. When something is a crime, you cannot turn it into a policy choice and then say, from now on, elect Democrats if you don't want torture, and expect torture to actually end. Torture is ongoing because people know they won't be prosecuted for it.
And you're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO in Portland. My guest is David Swanson, and we're talking about his book, Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. If you would like to give us a call and join the conversation, you can call us at 503-231-8187. And I believe we have Scott, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you, Marianne. David, I heard you this morning on a commercial station, KPOJ, and you had just discovered that the city of Portland has what we call voter-owned elections, or city-financed elections for candidates that qualify. Could you expand more on maybe the local, as democracy is basically an experiment made up of many levels of government where often national government can learn from what local and state governments do. Maybe that's something that we feel we have more control over. Could you talk about that? And then lastly, about actually the mechanisms for getting rid of the Senate altogether.
Sure. We do obviously have much more control over local governments in most cases around the country and over state governments as compared to national. And we have to work on that. But of course, there is the danger of passing good policies at the local or state level and having them overturned at the state or national level. We cannot give up the national fight. The militarism and the wars will destroy us. But, you know, we can't get the Congress to create a Department of Peace, but we can do that at the state level. We can't bring the Army home, but we can bring the state National Guard home. There are ways we can operate at the local and state levels that directly impact national policy. And we can't immediately get clean elections or free media for campaigns at the national level, but states can set that example, and cities doing it within a state can help to pressure a state to do it. So it's absolutely essential that people work at the local and state level. It also encourages people who need victories to keep fighting, because they win victories at the local and state levels and are willing then to fight harder at the national level. So there's no question that it's needed, but then we have to communicate nationally our victories at the local level, because nobody knows about them unless we do that ourselves. Mechanisms for getting rid of the Senate, there's only one. It's to amend the Constitution, and it would be the most difficult amendment to the Constitution, which says effectively that you can't do that. But it has to be done. We need a major overhaul of our Constitution. It's barely been tweaked in 2.25 centuries. It is far out of date, and it used to be cutting edge, but ending the filibuster and dramatically improving an anti-democratic institution like the Senate, we can do that tomorrow simply by changing the rule.
I have one more question on your the Bybee. Since he apparently, I don't know if he actually stops into Portland.
He does. He does.
I did know there was some protest. I don't know if you know this, but is it possible that instead of relying on the U.S. Attorney General, could a state attorney general or even the local Multnomah County district attorney convene a grand jury or levy an indictment based on just the public record that we have prima facie evidence of international war crimes or crime violations of the crime against torture, and that some of those tortures also led to death, which would allow for just a good old-fashioned murder trial? Is that something that's possible?
Absolutely. If they have any guts and ambition and decency and can find jurisdiction, and torture is illegal under most state laws, warrantless spying is illegal under most state laws, and everybody in this state, as every other state, has been spied on without warrants. If a prosecutor, local or state, has the nerve to take on war as a crime of murder, they should get in touch with my friend and former prosecutor Vince Bugliosi and pursue that. Absolutely.
I did want to have one last comment, and thank you, which is that I actually spoke to the Attorney General specifically about Vincent Bugliosi's book. I got a copy of Vincent Bugliosi's book. I did an interview on KABU, which I think is on the KABU website, with Vincent about this concept. And the idea is that he literally wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. He laughed, and he said our current Attorney General, which has many good qualities, laughed and said he wouldn't even read the book because it appeared to me that he thought it was crazy. So this is the main thing, is that, you know, these are political folks. Our attorney general and our district attorney are elected, and if the people don't ask for them to do something that requires bravery, then they just won't do it.
Well, you're absolutely right, and the people could force them to do it. Then you still have the danger of the Supreme Court being the blockage, and the Supreme Court we do not elect or control, which is why, while I support Vince's argument and want all of these angles pursued to the utmost, I have to stress going after Congress to use its powers, because we can control it more so and more reliably than we can control any of these other institutions.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call, Scott. And the number to call if you want to join the conversation is 503-231-8187. Now, in your book, you go over a lot of how we got into the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But lying to get into war is nothing new. What was different about this current round of it?
It was more blatant. It was more arrogant. The lies were more obvious, almost to the point of assuming that they wanted us to understand them as lies. The assertions were open that the president didn't need the lies, that the president didn't need the Congress, that the president simply had the power to declare war and would use it if he saw fit, would ask Congress for an authorization and proceed to violate it, but assert the power to operate without that authorization, would go to the United Nations in an attempt to get their support, but would go to war regardless of whether it was obtained or not. And the stupidity and the arrogance of the lies was extreme. It was insulting. And to many people who don't know that much about U.S. history, including Vince Bugliosi, who does not think we've ever been lied into a war before this one, this was all brand new, and it offended a great many people.
So can you give us some examples of wars that we got lied into before?
Well, it would be harder to give you examples of wars we did not get lied into, right? We had a ship carrying weapons that was sunk that we lied and pretended was not carrying weapons and got into World War I. Enforcing deadly sanctions and making threats and arming ships to fire against Japan, and Japan fired on us first, and we got into World War II and pretended that was completely out of the blue. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution is familiar to most people. The ship that sank in Cuba that got us into the Spanish-American War was indeed blown up from within, not from without. The babies yanked out of incubators that got us into the first Gulf War, of course, didn't exist. I don't know of a war that we weren't lied into, but in many cases we find out about the lies with solid documented evidence of them decades later, many decades later in some cases. Here we knew the lies up front, and the American people became aware of the lies in a way that hadn't happened even with Vietnam, I think, and is the primary reason we haven't gone into Iran on the basis of very similar lies. So to the extent that we continue drawing those parallels between Iran or anywhere else they're trying to lie us into and the Iraq lies, we may be able to prevent wars.
Okay, you're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO. My guest is David Swanson. You're going to be speaking at Powell's tonight, aren't you?
7:30 tonight at Powell's, the main Powell's location, yeah.
Now, when we got into this war in Afghanistan first and then Iraq, it was based on intelligence that was presented as a case that airtight case that Saddam was a danger to everyone. And of course, this turned out to be ridiculous, but it does sort of bring up the point that we have these intelligence services that operate in complete secrecy with no oversight. Do you think there's any possibility of getting those under control?
I think there is, although I would prefer to eliminate them rather than getting them under control.
But don't we need agencies that spy on other countries?
The people who had the best intelligence, properly deserving that name, on the lead up to 9/11, intelligence that was ignored, people like my friend Colleen Rowley in Minnesota, worked for the FBI, and their names and identifications and job responsibilities and street addresses were public. They did not need to be operating in secret. A partway reform, as the filibuster removal would be a partway reform with the Senate, would be to limit the CIA and the so-called intelligence agencies to intelligence, because not only do they operate in secret with secret budgets, but they are permitted to do anything, including serve as assassination squads, which is what they do now, which is why people are being assassinated in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and the CIA is using unmanned drones to kill people, and may or may not have been involved in this incident that may or may not have happened within the past couple of weeks, where 8 students were apparently dragged out of their beds and handcuffed and shot. These sort of things are not unusual for the CIA and for our secret agencies, because they're not limited to spying. If they want to make a case for the value of their spying, although I certainly don't see it, okay, but take away the right to be a gang of international thugs and murderers.
And the number, if you want to join the conversation, is 503-231-8187. My guest is David Swanson. So can you go over some of the rights that you go in the book that should be added to the Bill of Rights? I mean, it's easy to focus on what's wrong, but let's go over things that we should be focusing on to kind of make things better.
Well, I think we should have the right to vote, not just the right not to be discriminated against if we belong to certain groups, but the individual national right to vote. And
how would that be different from what we have right now?
Well, we don't have that right now, and it would permit national voter registration automatically without having to go out and register people and think of that as activism. It would promote national, it permit national voting standards, which I would suggest should be paper ballots publicly counted at every polling place. It would be a dramatic change from the hodgepodge of state and local systems we have now.
Isn't it better to keep things like the voting laws about voting on a local level? Because isn't that one of the problems that we have, that so much of the power has gone national, that keeping it local gives us more control over it?
In theory, I'm with you, and in many cases, I think that power needs to be shifted more to the state level and more to the local level. But if you're going to have a national election, you should have national standards. And if the states and localities were doing a remotely decent job, I think we would be much better off. Currently, the federal policy pushes states and localities in the wrong direction and funds them using machines that don't allow any verifiability. So that the federal policy, the national policy, is moving in the wrong direction at this point.
Okay, and we have a caller. Good morning, Jack.
Yes, I guess that you couldn't have gone in the direction you went with this conversation without expecting this call. But my question is that you cited so many incidents that have led to war that have we learned later were setups or instigated or whatever classic term, false flags, without citing 9/11 as one. And I'm just a little bit concerned why you stopped there when so many have raised the proposition that 9/11 was indeed probably the most heinous, the biggest, most tragic, spectacular false flag of all time. And it's just a curiosity to me, when the wars got started, there was a movement to try to shut them down by getting to the basis of that lie and the myth surrounding that, the myth-encrusted Islamofascist idea. And many in the peace movement wouldn't touch it. They wouldn't come close to it. And there was this huge schism in the progressive movement over that issue. And I'm just curious about why you avoided it just now.
I think that a serious investigation of 9/11 is absolutely required immediately, has never happened, and that it is an enormous national scandal. I do not think that any story about 9/11 could possibly be a legal justification for a war, regardless of what did or did not happen. We were told that we were going into a war on the basis of revenge against criminals. whether you think those criminals existed or were responsible for the crime or partly responsible for the crime, that's not a legal basis for a war. And we were sent into Iraq on the basis of completely other additional blatant lies. I think that, however, that 9/11 was a crime of criminal negligence by President Bush. I worked with Congressman Dennis Kucinich on an article of impeachment against President Bush for that negligence. I do not find what you are inclined to believe about 9/11 to be at all likely, but I'm 100% in favor of an investigation that would go after it. However, it is one of the smaller crimes of Bush and Cheney. We're talking about a few thousand people. Of course, the lies about it and the mythologies about it and the propaganda coming out of it were used to launch all of the larger crimes by Bush and Cheney. But that's the case regardless of what actually happened that day or not.
Right. Actually, what I'm inclined to believe is I don't think I made it completely clear in what I said, but what I'm inclined to believe is neither here nor there. Your notion about simply doing away with these intelligence agencies, I think, is probably the best. Don't forget to execute any traitors that you might find along the way, of course. But many would suppose that actually this event was pulled off by a shadow operation that has been around since the
whacking
of Kennedy, as it were. But at any rate, I do appreciate that you would call for the investigation, that you would call for the prosecution, as it would appear to be required.
Well, I did understand what you believed. I continue to find it highly improbable, and I respectfully do disagree with you on one other point, which is that I do not support the execution of anyone. We don't need any more information to know that treason has been committed by Bush, by Cheney, by many of their top subordinates. But executing people, revenge against people, is the sort of mental attitude that allowed them to take us into wars on the basis of revenge. We need to get beyond that kind of thinking. These people need to be in prison cells for decades, publicizing their remorse. Nothing would do more to deter repetitions of their crimes.
Okay, and thank you for your call, Jack.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening. Okay, good morning, Steve.
Hey, good morning. I was listening earlier, and I heard a gentleman talk about how our own district attorney here in Portland laughed about Bully Olsey's attempt to bring the Bush crime family under charges. My question is, if the district attorney took an oath to uphold the Constitution, isn't he in violation of not going after the crime family of the Bushes for not, it seemed like to me that he took an oath, and then he laughed at the notion of letting those criminals off, that he should be impeached or at least taken out of office.
Well, I believe it was the Attorney General the caller mentioned, but whoever it was, the same truth applies, and you're absolutely right, and they are violating their oath. And most elected officials at the local level, school boards and everything across the country, take an oath to the Constitution and nothing else. And most people have no idea what's in the Constitution, but it is being grossly violated at all levels. And whether you can pursue criminal charges for that is going to be a very uphill fight, but when these people are elected, you can unelect them and you can pressure them, and that certainly needs to be done. And there ought to be local and state pressure in this state to uphold laws that the Justice Department in Washington has openly said it will not uphold.
There are mechanisms within the Constitution to take these people out of office if they are in treason with the Constitution.
Well, Jay Bybee is a federal official, and
he'll take an oath, right?
He does indeed, and he can be impeached by the United States Congress. Congress can't impeach state and local officials, but it can impeach any federal official or president or vice president. We impeached a judge from Texas this year in Congress for groping somebody. If it's a Democrat, if sex is involved, there's still impeachment. But if it's a member of the executive branch, or if Fox News wouldn't like it, if it's a right-wing judge, if it's someone who's covering up crimes that the new president still wants covered up, then there's no more impeachment because Congress takes its orders from a party rather than from the law. And the Justice Department openly takes its orders not to enforce our laws from the president. So anything we can do at the local and state levels to throw a wrench into this and say, hey, we in Oregon want our laws enforced, could make a huge difference.
It just seems strange to me that if you take an oath and you don't hold up to your oath, that you can still stay in office.
Well, you know, the president took an oath to the – had to take it twice because the Supreme Court justice couldn't say his line. But he took an oath to the same Constitution. He received a Nobel Peace Prize and in a first in the world went and gave a Peace Prize acceptance speech advocating for the merits of wars and declaring his right to launch wars at his whim, regardless of the fact that under the Constitution, the U.N. Charter is the supreme law of our land and it forbids such things. And the Constitution forbids such things to a president. It gives them to the Congress. So it is quite widespread and becoming accepted in our society that the Constitution is simply discarded.
That's mainly because of the dumbing down of our educational system. Most of our teachers in schools do not teach civics any longer.
Well, I think we have to look at the role of the media. Working at some place like KABU, we're very aware of the fact that a lot of times we're the only voices and the major media doesn't cover what's really going on.
Yes, indeed. You come out of school not knowing much, but you turn on your television and you're dumber than you were before you turned it on. And there have been studies. And the people who still believe Saddam Hussein attacked the World Trade Center and there's nothing wrong with our climate and so forth, more of them watch Fox News than anything else. And you can go down the list of media outlets where they get their so-called news from and see which lies they are more likely to believe. The media is the biggest expense in our elections. It is the number one excuse of Congress members and their staff why they won't listen to us. The media wouldn't like it. It is far and away the biggest problem.
Yeah, but the thing is, none of this is done by accident. This is all by design to dumb down the U.S. population, the American people, so they can usurp their power and usurp the country. I mean, this is all done by design. By what government or by what group, I don't know, but it's done by design.
Well,
I think if it was all by accident, it would be a really amazing set of coincidences. But
not by accident.
Well,
yeah.
We've made our media a for-profit system. We don't have serious public media like they have in Europe. We don't fund newspapers. We don't teach people to read in schools. And it's this philosophy of for-profit and then the profit interest. And in fact, the interest by some parties of dumbing people down that leaves us where we are. We need a different mentality. We need different public policies, and we need different approaches by individuals. Now, the easiest thing anybody can do is support something like KABU, and for God's sake, stop taking out ads in corporate newspapers on behalf of peace and justice groups, newspapers without which we wouldn't have these wars. The easiest thing for any individual to do is to move their support to good media.
I agree.
But the problem with that is the media that has the big audiences. You know, when you say the peace and justice groups shouldn't take out the ads in the major newspapers.
But the solution is not to go where the big audiences are. The solution is to bring the audiences to where the good media is. And if good media outlets had more money, they would reach bigger audiences. I think it's counterproductive to say we have to give the New York Times $100,000 because all of the people who don't understand anything read the New York Times. I think it's shooting ourselves in the foot.
Yeah, and it just like how we were talking about the education system and the mass media, are dumbing down Americans. Part of the problem also is that when we have the government regulation taken off of the media, which then gives us bad information, and then it feeds on itself. So we kind of have these cycles that are feeding into each other. And the question is, where do you put a break in the cycle and start reversing things?
Well, again, you can have successes at the local and state levels more quickly than nationally, but the media is the biggest problem. We need equal access to media. We need free and open internet. We need high-speed internet everywhere. We need access to cable and satellite everywhere, although I encourage most people to stop watching television and read the right websites and listen to the right radio shows and produce your own media. And when you hold events and you do things, document it. And when Jay Bybee next sits in court in Portland, be there, have a video camera, talk to him, talk to the other justices about the shame they should feel for sitting on a court with him and not removing him, and make your own media. Some of the best clips that end up on the television news shows and the cable news shows are produced by people who bring a camera with them and make their own media.
Okay, and if you want access to the media, you can give us a call here, 503-231-8187. I'm Marianne Barasonic. You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO in Portland. And my guest is David Swanson. So if you had to focus on what would be the two most effective actions we could do within the next 6 months, what do you think those would be?
Well, one strategy that I think you have to start with is building or working with existing groups that are independent. Most labor unions, most activist groups, most public policy groups are taking their orders from the very people they're pretending to lobby, are going to the congressional leadership or even the Progressive Caucus or usually the White House and asking, what should we lobby you to do? And then going out to their members and saying, here's what you should advocate, which is why we were all told in organizations where 85% of us want single-payer health care, we were all told, don't say single-payer health care, hold your rallies without mentioning it, start with asking for the public option, which left us very little room to negotiate down and have anything worth keeping. So find organizations. I work with some groups that even have a party name in their name, like Democrats.com and Progressive Democrats of America, that are far more independent. And there are many local and national groups that are more independent than most of them, but only fund and only support and only create new groups that are Democratic with a small D internally, that ask you what message to take to Washington. And then you can support a bill that's a halfway compromise, but you do it without self-censorship, where you do it without preemptively compromising and opening the debate by narrowing the framework. And so I think that's fundamentally important. I think we have a golden opportunity when we've given one of the two parties overwhelming control of both houses plus the White House, and they're choosing to do nothing, to say to people, look, this is not the moment to go crawl under your bed and cry or move to Canada. This is the moment to understand that these are our elected representatives, regardless of party, and they're not your friend on your team, and they're not your enemy. You have to go after them, reward when they do things right and punish when they do things wrong. And mostly they do things wrong. And the top value here is not politeness. Go to their offices, sit there, refuse to leave, bring the television cameras, and go to jail. It's not dangerous. It's not traumatic. Feel free to consult a lawyer. Get good advice. Know what you're risking. But for the most part, it is something that has to be done to disrupt these people's business, because they are committing murder on a major scale.
Okay, so we have a caller. Hello, girl from Olympia. Hello? I think maybe we lost her.
Hello?
Oh, there we go. Yes, good morning.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest if he could elaborate on the idea of corporate personhood.
Well, you know, we may have a ruling on the 12th of this month. There's a distinct possibility in which the Supreme Court says no more limits at any time on any corporate money in elections, which is going to mean sums of money that dwarf anything we've ever seen, levels of corruption that make minuscule all of what we've seen heretofore, on the basis of the idea that corporations are persons and persons have First Amendment rights to free speech and spending money is speech, which is absolute nonsense and a crazy interpretation of the Constitution that's been built up, especially in recent years, through court rulings. And there are major coalitions being put together that will be launching the day this happens to reverse it, including by pushing for constitutional amendments to take away First Amendment rights from corporations. It's insane for us to be giving corporations rights while we're stripping them away from people. We have court rulings just yesterday. We had a court ruling in Washington taking away the right to habeas corpus from people while we're giving these rights to corporations. Corporations overrule us in election procedures and in all sorts of First Amendment issues. So it's going to be one of these opportunities to harness outrage from people across the political spectrum who say, no, we will not stand for this. It's going to be another one of these moments where we say, if anything can get Americans off their couches, this has got to be it.
Okay, and so when is this coming up?
Well, it may never happen. I hope it never happens. It may be put off for months or years, but there is the distinct possibility that the Supreme Court will put out its ruling on January 12th, possibly the 11th, probably the 12th. And it may be a very narrow ruling. It may be very broad, and it may be broad to the point of denying states the ability to eliminate corporate personhood rights. This would be the worst, would overturn many state laws. We'll see, but they've gone out of their way to get this case with the apparent intention of doing this. It will be an incredible outrage, and it will be dependent on media outlets like this one to tell people what's happened.
And also people could look at your website.
Yes, go to davidswanson.org, afterdowningstreet.org. There are going to be new websites not yet announced, launched on that day. So be prepared to get involved.
Okay, I think that's really good advice. And I don't think we have any more callers. Okay, David, any parting words for activists in Portland?
Well, I'll come to Powell's at 7:30 this evening, and I'd love to talk with you in person and sign a book for you. And we didn't get a chance to say a lot about rights that we should have that we don't, but because I went on too long about voting, but we'll talk about that this evening at Powell's.
Okay, great. I'm Marianne Barasonic. You've been listening to Political Perspectives. My guest has been David Swanson, and a big thanks to my engineer, Kurt Lauer.